Sheffield Live, made in Sheffield, made by you.
Do you want to get your message heard? With low advertising rates and great sponsorship opportunities, Sheffield Live can help you reach thousands of local people. Get your campaign on Sheffield Live. To find out more about advertising on Sheffield Live, write to advertising@sheffieldlive.org or call 0114 281 4082.
Hello, good evening. Here we are again. It's Deserted Island Dis. It's the show where we try and get people from the island of Ireland to come and talk to us about their life and their life's journey. And they're now living in Sheffield and we play some music. But for some weeks now, I've run out of Irish people. So it's what's lucky about the show, what's great about the show, I now get to just do interesting people. And I've had a lot of interesting people over the last few weeks who are not from Ireland. But what they've been able to do is introduce me to other interesting people. And I've got one of those here tonight. Hello. Hello, Oriel.
Hiya. Right? All right, Ben.
Thanks for coming in to do the show. So I've just working out. We've just had a bit of time together, me and Oriel. And we've never met, we don't think. No. We've probably been in the same room a few times. So I've been in Sheffield 25 years. You're from this region. We'll find out more about it. And you've been doing great things in Sheffield and Sheffield community. So what I'm trying to do is give the audience a bit of a flavour of you. So who we're talking to for the next hour. Yeah. You've got some amazing song choices. But to try and describe you is really, really difficult. But just to say, I suppose, you're really successful. Is that fair to say?
Depends how you're judging it, but yeah, I guess so. Yeah, no, I do.
I know people don't like the. It's hard, isn't it, to kind of big yourself up, isn't it? But that's my job, really.
Depends what you're judging it on. Yeah, I do all right.
Yeah.
I've had a good life.
But, well, from what I've seen, so I've had, done a bit of research and what people have said is you have been successful in different careers, I suppose, and different aspects of where you're at. And we're going to learn like how what you do, which is lots of different things. But what we do is try and start at the beginning. So it's your kind of life story. And it's good to know you're another Rotherham person who's done well. There's so many that I've met that are often living in Sheffield now, I have to say.
Yeah, we don't go far, if at all.
So tell us a bit about that then. So, I mean, you can tell it better than me, but kind of, I suppose, when you was born and just a bit about your parents and all that kind of stuff. It's really interesting.
Well, I wasn't born... So I was brought up in Rotherham from, I think, the age of about two.
Right.
But I wasn't born there. So my dad had come over as part of that, what do you call it, the diaspora, but, you know, the wave of people from the... I'm doing inverted commas, air commas, but the colonies, you know.
Yeah.
So the countries that were colonised and then recruited doctors and nurses. So he was part of that wave. So he was a doctor, came over from India on a ship, ship's doctor, washed up in Wales, so that would have been, I think he got to the UK in 59.
Okay, so he was a doctor on a ship, so he's...
Yeah, he was a doctor, he was trained in India, born in Calcutta, and he'd done his training there, was highly qualified. Anyway, he came over here, he followed the call of, you know, adventure, and worked his passage over here, and ended up, for some reason, maybe he just went where the jobs were, he ended up in South Wales.
Okay.
And my mother was Welsh. And I think they met when she was about 17 or 18. So he'd have been, like early mid-20s then. So he was a young man.
Yeah.
So he had this job as a hospital doctor in Wales. And she left school at 14 because she came from a really, like, poor family. They didn't have a lot of money. So she couldn't carry on with her education, left school at 14, and then she couldn't go nursing until she was 17.
Yeah.
So I think when they met, she was 17 or 18. Anyway, it was love over the bedpans, you know.
Yeah,
so
they
courted, as they said, in those days. So that would have been like 1958.
Wow, yeah.
Fell in love. And it was very taboo then, you know. Yeah. Can imagine.
Is that on both sides? So it's like, I mean, did you have much contact with his family back in India?
Or it's just sort more of on... fallen out with them because they, I mean, it's all, they're both passed now, but, you know, so they're not there to give the kind of first-hand account. But the my grandfather on the Indian side was part of the whole Quit India campaign. So he was part of fighting against the British.
Yeah.
As they, you know, as they, so he's part of that Indian independence movement.
Yes. Yeah,
and
so
he was a raging, raging communist.
And, yeah,
so this would have been, Indian independence was 47.
Yeah, yeah, so.
So he was a raging communist, my grandfather.
Right.
And I think my dad wasn't left wing enough for him. So they'd had, it's quite mysterious, but I think they'd had some falling out.
Yeah.
Which sort of contributed to my dad leaving India, but I think he just...
And did you get to meet your grandfather? Or?
No, I never met him. We had this trip planned when I think I was about 15 or 16, and unfortunately he'd been ill for a long time, right. And then we never got over there in time, but met the rest of the family. But like a lot of Indian families, we're not all in India, you know.
Yeah.
There's relatives all over, especially...
Like the Irish.
Yeah, exactly. You know, we never stayed at home, but talk about home all the time. Yeah. So, you know, you'll get like third generation who are in New York or something, and they're talking about home that they probably...
Do they write songs about it like the Irish do?
There's a lot of crying and poetry and all that kind of stuff. But so that there was like love over the bedpans. And then my dad was travelling round. Sorry, I've got to keep my thread. This is how I arrived in Rotherham.
Yeah.
So he was very ambitious, and my mum was a real grafter. They were both grafters, but she was one of those like the force behind him, you know, like pushing him. So he travelled round, he'd taken better and better jobs, you know, so he sort of worked his way up. And there was a lot of, as you can imagine, like against the Irish, a lot of discrimination.
Of course, yeah.
So he wasn't getting the kind of plum jobs, and he'd have to travel or have these interviews. And he always used to tell stories about how he'd go and they'd let him stay overnight, and then he'd have a free meal in the kind of, they used to have these quite posh canteens for the doctors. So he'd always fill his boots, you know, so he wouldn't have to pay for food. And, you know, all those stories. But they ended up, after a few years of doing this, like moving around, having these sort of better and better jobs, he ended up in Rotherham.
Yeah.
And he said, I always said to him, why did you end up in Rotherham? Because by this time he was extremely qualified, and they'd spent a year in Edinburgh where he did his fellowship at the Royal College of Surgeons. And I think he was, at the time, he was one of the youngest that had ever got it.
Yeah.
So he's massively...
qualified.
Really qualified. FRCS, you know, for anybody, it's one of those sort of certifications. But I said, why Rotherham? Couldn't you have had your pick? And he said, no, you'd go to anywhere in the country, and if it was a plum job, it would always go to the lesser qualified white guy. They just didn't, and women probably didn't get a look in.
Yeah.
So he said Rotherham was the only place that would take him.
That took him, yeah.
And he was in orthopaedic, so he, sadly, he ended up in the ward that he'd set up. But when, so this would have been in the, I was two, so it would be about 64.
Yeah.
He rocked up in Rotherham, and that was it. So,
he created a ward there. And,
yeah, he created a ward.
And stayed there all his life, is it?
All his working life. Yeah. He gave his everything to the NHS and was very proud of it. And then ended up on that ward. He died over in Sheffield in a hospice. But
he got there,
But it was good, kind of, I don't know, it was sort of, although it was sad, there were lots of nurses and things who'd worked with him. So it was kind of fitting, really, in the end.
Yeah. So are you the oldest of...
There's four of us, three boys and me. I'm the difficult second one.
The second one, yeah. But what I was saying, was your mum staying back in Wales while he was travelling to start
with?
No,
she went with him.
Everywhere around the country,
kids.
Lots of different...
She worked really hard, but she'd...
doing nursing, was it?
Different times. Yeah. It was one of those. I don't know why she stopped, because she was a real worker, but she'd stopped working.
Right.
And just basically, stopped working. She only brought up four of us, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So she worked hard.
Yeah.
But I think he was her job. And then later in Rotherham, actually, she was a magistrate, which she was very proud of.
Oh, brilliant! Yeah.
Very proud of.
So again, like community spirit and
My dad gave both of them gave a lot to Rotherham, and they're well remembered there, which is it's nice. And I do a lot in Rotherham now. So So that's where it all started.
Yeah.
2 years old, Rotherham.
Yeah. Which part of the show is getting these songs in, but we've already chatted far too long, which is not a bad thing.
Yeah, let's fast forward.
No, it's good. Well, I suppose like bringing the songs in. Let's play your song. So your first song choice is probably when you're a bit older, obviously. So it's your choice, "Golden Years" by David Bowie. Just what that means to you, why you picked that?
Yeah, well, it's a nice challenge actually to have stories that tell songs that tell the story of your life. It's different to your funeral songs, which I choose on the regular, but because that would be a different choice altogether. Although it might be some of them are the same, actually. But anyway, so Golden Years came out. I checked, it was 1976, and it was the first record I bought with my own money.
Yeah.
And I just...
How did you get the money?
I I don't think I'd have been working then, so I'd have been 14. So I started working at 15 in a sports shop in the market that isn't there anymore because the market's been knocked down. And then I worked in a pub. So, like, our whole family are very, very hardworking.
Yeah,
my kids are the
same.
Anyway, so I didn't have any money at that point. So it'll have been pocket money
birthdays,
whatever. And it would have cost pennies. And it would have either been Woolworths or Boots. In Rosrum, used to sell records.
I remember Woolworths was there for a long time.
Was the place you went for your records, and they had bargain bins, and you know, you'd...
Yeah.
And then there was a record shop called Singles in Rotherham. I don't think I'd have been brave enough to go in there, so I probably bought it in Woolies. But I just loved... I didn't know anything about David Bowie, but the cover of it is really glamorous. And I've always had a hankering for glamour and, you know, that kind of... And then it's just such a funky track. I think I just loved the beat and the... I don't think I knew what the lyrics meant or... anything like that. It was just such a...
The beat.
Well, listen to
and
it yourself.
Bowie.
Yeah.
Let's play it. Golden Years.
Taking you nowhere.
Angel,
come for the baby. Look at that sky, life's begun. Nights are warm and the days are young. Come for the baby. This might be the lost, that's all. Opening doors and pulling some strings.
Angel,
come for the baby. In walk luck and you looked in time. Never look back, walk tall, act fine. Come for the baby.
I'll stick with you, baby, for a thousand years. Hope there's more to touch you in these golden years.
Down where you once belonged, in the back of a dream car, 20-foot long. Don't cry, my sweet, don't break my heart. Doing all right, we've gotta get smart. Wish upon, day upon day. I believe, oh Lord, I believe all the way.
Come
for the baby, run for the shadows, run for the shadows, run for the shadows in these golden years.
There's my baby lost, that's all.
Me hear you say life's taking you nowhere.
Angel,
come for the baby. Run for the shadows, run for the shadows, run for the shadows in these golden.
David Bowie, and that's the choice of Ariel. Ariel, I've done it again. Ariel, my guest tonight on Deserted Island Disc. So we're just going through Ariel's childhood, really, and talking about her parents and a bit about... that was the first record she ever bought in Rotherham. So we've not really touched on your Rotherham days, but Well, you take it from wherever you want.
Yeah, I mean, that's a banger of a track, isn't it? It's nice to listen to it again. So I guess the next track I've chosen, I'll line that up. So classic. When I was choosing, I thought, I'm not even going to bother trying to be cool and choose what's cool. I'll just choose actually tracks that were really meaningful. And this next one is, I mean, a lot of girls love Joni Mitchell. Yeah. And like a lot of women, I love Joni Mitchell. And I came across her album, Blue, which I think came out in 71, but I mean, it was just not on my radar. So, but around, maybe just after that, I bought that Bowie track. My mum and dad, we've got relatives, Indian relatives in America, because as we were saying, you know, they're all far-flung, they're all over the world. And they'd gone to see some relatives and they'd come back with vinyl, like they just bought bits. I think maybe the relatives had said, oh, take this. And in amongst this kind of bundle of stuff was Blue, you know, with that iconic colour. Her face.
It was in my mum and dad's collection.
Oh, I mean, it's stunning. And it looks stunning, but, you know, what a gift for an emo 14, 15-year-old. So that I call that the bedroom years. Like, that was, you know, it was tricky being mixed race in Rotherham.
Yeah.
As a lot of people know, and you know, and girls do spend a lot of time in their bedrooms, kind of, you know, you play with your makeup and I used to write sad poetry and, you know, a lot of that kind of stuff. And she was the soundtrack to all of that. And then what was beautiful many, many years later was I introduced it to my daughter, more of which later, my queen. And she's adores her as well. And we just, you know, we don't do listening parties about Joni, but we've got a plan for when Joni passes. It's like, we, you know, that's our day basically to celebrate. But yeah, it's very special to me. So every track on the album is stunning and has so much meaning for me. But I've chosen Blue just because it's the title track and it's just gorgeous.
Okay, let's play it. We'll play that one and then we'll talk some more about your life. So this is Blue, Joni Mitchell. Beautiful Joni. Some great choices. So, Oriel, my guest tonight on Deserted Island Disc. With two songs in, and they're both fantastic. So, classics, one might say. But it changes, doesn't it, the next ones? Let's not... we'll tease you a bit, the audience, yeah, to say that there's a big change for the next ones, but we need to get there in your life story. So,
yeah.
I suppose what I'm interested, you touched on a bit about you kind of working from like 15, you were saying, and then did you have that work ethic?
But, yeah.
And then you're at school, but then you... Did you know what you wanted to do?
I had no clue what I wanted to do. If I'd had my way, I'd have been... If I had my way now, I'd be a broke poet. You know, that's just what I'd do. But anyone who's got an Indian dad, I don't know if it's the same if you've got an Irish dad, but like my dad really grafted to make sure that we did better than him and well.
Yeah.
And so we were all going to be doctors, you know, lawyers, whatever. So classic. And I don't know if my brothers are listening, but I was the only one that really was going to make a go of that until I didn't. So he really, really wanted me to be a doctor, and I was studying sciences, but I'd had the soul of a poet. You know, you can tell I'm listening to Joni Mitchell. But I was very, very about, from a really young age, all about fairness and unfairness. So through my experiences of racism, I started really... thinking about it a lot and thinking, but this is just, as a kid, this is wrong. Why?
It's not fair.
You know, why are people treated differently? So it was no more thoughtful than that, but I just knew it was wrong. And then I started getting really interested in all of that. So I went off to uni, and I really broke my dad's heart because I didn't do medicine because I just couldn't face it. I just, there was something in me that just knew at 18 that I couldn't do it. It wasn't the life for me. So I went and did psychology.
Okay.
Because I was really interested in how people tick.
Yeah.
And that, which actually later on is what I've ended up doing because now I coach people.
Yeah, you see coaching people in that
so,
sense.
You know, which has a lot of psychology in it. But so I did a lot of, I mean, I'll fast forward through it, but so even though I went off to study psychology and then came back and I was on the dole for a bit. So it was in the years when you could sign on, you could get housing benefits, you know.
Yeah.
So we had a lot of freedom to work out what we were about. And then eventually this would have been about 82, 83.
Hold on, you're going too fast now.
No, hang on, let me go back. So I'd done this, like, campaigning all through my late teens, lots of marching, lots of...
Where did you go to uni, sorry?
I went to Durham.
Okay,
went up to the northeast and very posh. I wasn't posh.
So you got good grades, obviously A-levels to get in there.
Got pretty good grades, I think I maybe got one B+, and my dad said, "What on earth is this?" You know, in that way, like, what you mean? It's not all A's. So perfectionism was drilled in quite young.
And you went at 18, so like
I went at 18.
Did you feel young and in that?
I felt completely clueless.
Yeah,
and I've got to say, Durham. I mean, it's a beautiful place.
But it's renowned for having a lot of private school, public school.
It was lady this, lord that.
Yeah, yeah.
You know. Viscount the other. I've got to say, they were really nice kids, like, because they're very gracious. People who've grown up with money are very well-mannered and very great, you know, they go through life really easy. So I was tortured, like you tortured northern kind didn't know. They had these women who'd come and clean the rooms and they called them bedders. I mean, that was torture for me. Nobody had ever cleaned my room, do you know what I mean? I did it. But the poshos were kind of, but, you know, the more well-born.
To call them that.
Oh, can I call them the poshos? The poshos were, like, very gracious and not at all embarrassed because they were used to having people, you know, like servants.
And that confidence,
You know, so I had a lot of fun, but, again, it kind of really cemented this something, these inequities are just not right.
Because it's such in your face there, isn't it?
You know, and I mean, it was so stark, the haves and the have-nots. And, you know, and we were middle class. It wasn't that we didn't have, but it just revolted me. You know, it was like physical that this was just not right. And so when I came back to Sheffield, as I say, early 80s.
And did you come to Sheffield then, not Rotherham?
No, I went. No, there's no way I could have gone home. So I came back to Sheffield and lived in...
Why Sheffield?
I think, well, in fact, I'd met somebody. In fact, Kit and me, Kit was one of your previous guests.
Oh, yeah, Kit Bailey.
So Kit Bailey was, I think, about 18, and I ended up in a shared house with her through a mutual friend who I'd met when I was in Durham. She was from Hartlepool, this mutual friend. So we all were in a shared house, but we were all on the dole and just working out who we were, but doing a lot of political activism that you would call it now. We didn't call it that, but we went on a lot of marches. We were, it was the early days of kind of eco stuff. And,
yeah.
I mean, they were brilliant times, you know, just to have a voice politically and do a lot of that kind of being out on Fargate with petitions and going on Reclaim the Night marches. And it was when Bhopal happened, if you remember that awful disaster. Yeah, yeah. And it was very liberating, actually, and great to be out there and, like, out and proud, loud, you know.
Yeah,
like,
and you found a community or a tribe.
Definitely a community of activists. I mean, you know, it had its complications, like any of those communities do, but it was a real time of energy. And the time came where I'd been on the dole too long, and they had this thing called the community programme back then in the 80s, early 80s. So I had a choice. They offered me two jobs, and I had to take them or my dole was going to be cut. So I had a choice of going and being a producer on Radio Sheffield or being an advice worker at Woodseats Neighbourhood Advice Centre. I always wonder what would have happened if I'd gone down the Radio Sheffield route. But it was on an Asian programme and I took umbrage because I said, you've racially stereotyped me. Yeah, I should have been working on a mainstream programme. So I got a bit kind of iffy about them. So I went to Woodseats.
I'm just intrigued. Did you have any like experience, qualifications to be a producer on Radio Sheffield?
I volunteered for, oh God, what was the programme called? I can't remember. But it was like a youth programme with this amazing woman, anybody who remembers her, she was phenomenal, called Jane Kitson, who's sadly gone now. But she was just
She was at Radio Sheffield, and she was a producer. So there was some experience.
So I'd gone and like twiddled a few knobs and done a few playlists and things. So I was, and I was into it. Anyway.
So you went to be an advice worker.
I went to be an advice worker and I loved
amazing.
It.
Amazing. Yeah, no,
I loved
great.
It. Good, my good absolute stuff. Passion. And I did it for decades, actually.
Right.
Moving into policy. So we'll move into going to London. But the next song
you'd done, is that? Was that later? It doesn't all have to fit together.
It does fit together, actually, because a lot of... So this would have been mid to late 80s. I left Sheffield in 80. My husband will tell me off because I always get it wrong, but because I met him just before I left. But I think it was 89. Matt will tell me if it's wrong.
Was he the reason you left? Me too.
That's a whole other... That's a different kind of show. But anyway, so in those days, we did a lot of weekend raving. So you'd have a job and then you'd cane it, basically, every night and every weekend. And I was part of a scene around the very early days of house music, forget Manchester. Sorry, I know you're from Manchester, but it didn't start at the Hacienda. It started in Sheffield. And my husband, who I didn't know then, but I had my eye on him, used to run this amazing club called Jive Turkey,
which was
like the birthplace of all the scenes like Warp and Von Records and all these amazing things that happened. And I was couldn't stop me going. I used to go Saturday, there was Thursday night at the Lead Mill, there was Wednesday sometimes at occasions. There were just all these nights, so I was out. And this song really represents that whole kind of mid-late 80s working, dancing.
And you introduced it, because I might say it wrong.
People think it's all one word and it looks like Test One, but it's actually called Testone. And it's by two really now very famous people. So one of them is Richard H. Kirk, who was part of another one, sadly, who's not with us, who was part of Cabaret Voltaire, you know, famous Sheffield band. And then a guy called Richard Barrett, and together they're called Sweet Exorcist on this, but Richard Barrett is famously known as DJ Parrot, and he was the very famous DJ at Jive Turkey and went on to do... he's still around. He does all sorts of amazing things, like produced Britney Spears and just amazing people. Yeah. So he's a brilliant export from Sheffield.
Good. Let's play it then.
If everything's ready here on the dark side of the moon, play the five tones. Thank you.
Testone.
Testone. We faded it out because it's a fuck a great stonking. I was just thinking, actually, it's 7 minutes, but probably helped if you.
I get the gist.
No, I was going to say, if you're on a packet of Silk Cutter, because you could smoke indoors then, and a load of lager was my
time
would
go quickly. Yes,
yes, and then you could really get into it. So a lot of lager to help you.
It's a great song. So I've not heard that one before, but just I suppose the sound of it. I mean, you're educating me on the dance music scenes of where it's at. So you're right, as a Mancunian, I always thought we invented it all, but you can hear just in that track, which is an early track, it was, the preemption of stuff that you would hear at the Hacienda and later on in, the 90s stuff. Yeah.
It was the birth of Bleep. I mean, there's people who can tell the story better than me, because I always say, I talk a lot about it, actually, because I'm very passionate. Is passionate the word? Yeah, got very strong feelings about women in dance music, because a lot of the time our stories are erased, because the fellas like to tell the story as if there were no women there. So I've talked a lot about what it was like in those days. And I'm not a mate, I don't make music, but I was definitely around. And there were a lot of women who make music but don't like talking about it. So I talk about them.
Yeah,
do you know what I mean?
Right,
on their behalf. So it was a really cool time. I mean, it was a great time to be young. So that would have been, towards the late 80s. And it was that genre is Bleep, and it gave birth to things like Bassline and, things that Sheffield's really famous for.
Yeah, so like niche music kind of conceded that.
And Sheffield's really famous for it. People who are into house, people who are into techno, who know their origins, will always talk about Sheffield, as the birthplace of it. And I'm talking internationally, not just,
we have to do, there's so much that Sheffield does, isn't it? I think next year there's going to be a music exhibition celebrating Sheffield music, and there's so much that's been there. Apparently, Sheffield is the capital for barbershop music as well.
Is it really?
So there you go. Well, everything Sheffield music.
I did not know that. And also brass bands.
Brass bands,
I've got a really good friend who's a trombone player.
Yeah.
And he tells me about all these world-famous trombone players who are from Rotherham, in fact.
Wow.
But who knew?
I didn't know.
There you go.
Well, we could talk about Sheffield music, couldn't we? I'm sure we will some more. But it's back to you. So we'd got as far really as that you got your first proper job.
Yeah, I'm really into it. So I was doing advice work, and I guess it might be worth saying, because I was political. I was never party political. I kind of dabbled with Labour a bit, but I never really found a home in the party political. But I was I suppose what you'd call now social justice. That's what I was interested in, and I got really, really into what I believed, and I still believe it, is knowledge is power, and that's what advice work was about for me. It was never about me knowing more than somebody else. It was going, look, I've got the privilege of having access to this information, let me share it, and then you can do something with it. That was always where I was coming from, because I'd been in Rotherham Library when I was a kid and just like rinsed, just read every book on the shelves, like a lot of us did, self-educated in many ways. And I wanted to do that for people who didn't have access to information, because I just thought, if you've got information, you can do something with it.
Yeah.
So I still am very passionate about advice work. And so I stayed in it for a long time, but I got to the late 80s, and I'd really, the trouble with Sheffield, and I don't know if it's like this now, but the trouble then was, it was certainly the scenes I were in were very small, and I felt like I didn't have room to breathe, really. Do you know, it was a bit like you'd see the same people, and you'd spit on a Tuesday, and somebody go, "Oh, I heard you," and it just all got a bit much for me. And this amazing job came up, working as a homelessness advisor in Ealing, of all places, weirdly, for women. And I just thought, I'm ready.
Yeah.
And went off down to London. So this would have been 89, and I met Matt, who's now my husband, about 2 or 3 weeks before.
Well,
so that was
you'd
a bit,
already got a job and
we were just kind of a situationship, as they say now, at the time. But he followed me down anyway, so it carried on. But so it was the love of that work that took me down to London.
Great.
Rather than anything else, I wanted to see how far I could go.
Yeah.
In what I thought was purposeful work. I was never ambitious in terms of, having a well paid, I want
money and stuff.
But that never really turned me on. It was
Doing more good.
Doing more. So I ended up in Ealing and then lasted a couple of years.
Is that for the council?
For the Ealing Council.
Yeah.
Cut my teeth there. And then I worked for a few years in a most fantastic project in Notting Hill. Fantastic times. In a project under the Westway, if anybody knows the Westway, it's like a...
Yeah, the flyover thing. Yeah.
The flyover,
yeah.
Bottom of Portobello Road. Working for a thing called HAC, which was the Homelessness Advice Centre, which was a squatters' rights
place. I've heard of that. Yeah,
which had set up in a caravan
in
the 70s. I mean, unfortunately, it wasn't in a caravan when I got there, but it was a cooperative. So we worked, we didn't have a manager.
Yeah.
And we did so much campaigning. There's a lot of migrant labour in Kensington and Chelsea, although it's very rich in some places. Very, very deprived and disadvantaged in others. So it was, and we were part of, it was when HIV started to get very prevalent and we were just around the corner from Terence Higgins Trust and the Lighthouse. So we did outreach there, worked with Bart's HIV, worked in loads of mental health projects, did loads of migrant migrant labour campaigns. And it honestly, what a time.
Yeah.
And going out, still not so much clubbing and dancing, but... because the music wasn't as good.
Because it was London,
Just being part of London and being part of this, like, really purpose-led work. Oh, God, it was just great.
So how's that work? I mean, the cooperative bit, was it... so who decided kind of what work you do? Did you just do it together?
It was a nightmare, Ben, honestly. I mean, I don't know if... we used to have these Tuesday meetings. Right. Everybody was sleeping with everybody else. I mean, there was 10 of us. So it was one of those. It was like a family. No, not like a family. You know what I mean? Like a loose connection.
You had a good time.
Yeah, we had a really good time. A lot of falling out, but everybody very, very, very passionate and committed to the work.
And were you getting money? Was it
contracts? Yeah, we got money from Kensington to council. I mean, honestly, but we did it, mate. Everybody worked really hard.
No,
we
were
open on Saturdays, and we'd go and do emergency stuff and when people were getting evicted. But we used to have these all-day Tuesday meetings, which would do everything from who hasn't done the washing up through to how do we respond to this policy direction
from the council.
But we just kind of mucked in. I mean, it was a real baptism of fire.
Amazing.
I mean, you know, every so often that idea of collective working will raise its head again and I just kind of shake my head in the corner. Like.
But last week's guest, we had James Lockwood, who was at Opus, and it's kind of that. I suppose it's moved on a bit. So it does happen still, and it seems to be really successful at Opus Independence, doing great works in Sheffield. So you should two get together, last week's guest and this week's guest.
I've still got that spirit in me, you know. I still like doing things in a different way.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of people in Sheffield like that. You know, we're not all doing it like we're supposed to.
We better play a record. So we've got Astral Weeks next.
I know. Sorry, I've really gone for the...
We're not going to play all of this one either.
No, I think this is another 7 minute long. Yeah, but all we need is the first like 30 seconds because everybody will know it. But this for me really, really reminds me of that time. And I don't think I'd heard of Van Morrison.
Yeah.
But I used to go drinking. I had a friend who was half Irish and very, very proud of being half Irish. And we used to go drinking in the pubs on the Holloway Road. And they were, I won't say too much about it, but they were very specific and the kinds of, politically very specific. And the kind of songs that were being sung were very specific.
Yeah.
And it was of a particular sort of movement. And I remember going out with some lad from the pubs, and he played me Astral Weeks, and it remains my absolute favourite all time. You know, when you go, what's your top five albums? Yeah. It's number one always, even though I know Van isn't curmudgeonly old, what's it?
But,
he's problematic, but anyway, the music speaks for
itself.
Yeah, the music speaks for itself.
Let's play that one, Astral Weeks by Van Morrison.
If I ventured in the slipstream between the viaducts of your dream, where mobile steel rims crack and the ditch and the back road stop, could you find me? Or would you kiss my eyes, laying you down, silence easy to be born again. to be born again. From the far side of the ocean, if I put the wheels in motion, then I stand with my arms behind me. I'm pushing out the door. Could you find me? Would you kiss my eyes? Lay me down. The silence easy to be born again. To be born again. Standing with the look of avarice, talking to Heath Ledger, showing pictures on the wall, whispering in the hall. I'm pointing a finger at me. There you go, there you go.
Sorry, Van. I'm going to have to fade Van out. I'm sure he would be shouting at us for that, wouldn't he?
He would be really shouting.
So we've got my guest Oriol's on the show tonight. We've only got about 15 minutes left, and I don't feel we've kind of scratched the surface of it, really, of kind of your life. But it's been so interesting hearing your story. You've kind of... Well, the journey from Rotherham to London sounds amazing. And then you obviously ended up back here. Was that what... When? What happened? Why?
I spent 15 years in London. Loved it.
It's a long time, isn't it?
It is a long time, and it was the 90s for a lot of that time, and that's a whole other story. But, you know, brilliant and brutal in equal measure.
Politics.
Learned a lot. And then I had my oldest, who's 27 now, but so that would have been 99.
Yeah.
And I just wanted my mum.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, it's nothing more complicated than that. I sold up. I can't believe I sold my flat. I should have kept it, but anyway.
Yeah, well, I'm sure you made a bit of a profit.
Yeah. I bought my house up here, so yeah, that worked out. But so I came back up and ended up at Rotherham Council. Again, in that kind of social justice work. So I was an equalities worker, policy officer for the council at Sheffield. I did a little stint in Rotherham Council, didn't really get on with it.
Yeah,
moved to Sheffield. Well, I was in Sheffield and then moved to Sheffield Council.
Yeah.
Spent ages there and was just in policy for a long time. Had my kids, had my oldest and then had another one. So I've got two kids now.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, this is jumping forward a little bit, but I can go back if we need to. But I, 2011, if you remember, do you remember well, of course you do, the Tories getting in 2010.
Yeah.
And the start of austerity.
Yeah.
And the axe fell. And before that, I ended up as a head of department. But before that, 2010, we'd be asked to model efficiencies. You know, if you were going to make cuts, what would you do? But it was all a bit kind of game playing. And then suddenly it was like the money to local authorities was so drastically cut, and to the voluntary sector. And suddenly those model efficiencies had to be found. So I was cutting budgets. It was very painful times, you know, because I'm a public servant, you know, I really believe in it. And it hurt a lot to let people go to cut services.
Well, you got pretty senior in Sheffield Council, didn't you?
I was head of a department. I was sort of, at that point, I was trying to head for director and then, or at least assistant director. And I got to about 50 and I was like, do you know what? This is not happening for me. I don't think they see me like that. And maybe I haven't quite got the punch. And then what happened in 2010, it's like it was survival of the fittest.
Yeah.
It was, you know, there were some ruthless people around, which they probably needed to be honest. And I wasn't tough enough for it. I wasn't, because I believed in broader purpose, like in collegiate working, working to the collective, really. You know, I'm an old hippie like that. And I think...
That's a funny place to be then, the council, because the council's... It might have been, I don't know. People speak fondly of kind of 80s Sheffield councils.
I was around then as well.
But I think I moved to Sheffield in 2001, and certainly my experience with councils in that area wasn't like that. It was kind of, it was quite, business-like.
It was very business-like. And you know, to be fair to people, when you've got a really reduced budget, you've got to get sharp about what you're spending it on. I wasn't mad on a lot of the behaviours. It did bring out the worst in people. And I mean, I'll say it now. I think I was too soft.
Yeah.
You know, I wasn't that person. Anyway,
luckily, I think you do have to be.
You have to be pretty ruthless.
Driven and,
I don't know. It wasn't for me. Anyway, the upside of it was, I was given a coach because I think they wanted me to toughen up. So I was the first time I'd ever experienced coaching about 2010.
Well, that was nice of him.
Yeah. Well, it was a bit remedial, I think. Anyway, luckily for me, I had this amazing woman. Three sessions in, I was like a new girl. I was like, what? This is amazing. Fell in love with it. I was like, I didn't know you could do this for a living. And I went off to study at Sheffield Hallam. I did their master's course in coaching and mentoring. I never thought I could have another passion, but that was the one.
Yeah. Amazing.
And so I left.
And that's
about a year into the course, I left and set up on my own.
Let's do another song so we can squeeze the two choices you've got left. Because these were the last two of the ones you really want to play, aren't
they? Yeah,
so,
these are for my babies, for my little babies.
So we'll do that and then we'll come back to talk about what you're up to these days.
I'd love to. So I'll do a little kind of teaser, a little segue for both of them. So the first one, my queen, my daughter, she's just my person. And this is one of the songs I'll have played at my funeral, but it's a song that just makes me think of her walking along the street, smiling, happy. I love it. And then I'll say the second one when we play it.
Yes.
It's written by my son, but I'll say a bit more when we get to that.
What's your daughter called, sorry?
She's called Bieber, after the shop from the 60s, if anybody remembers that. So Bieber Florence.
So this is When I See You Smile by Singing Sweet.
Oh, baby, I don't know my lady, I don't know she baby, yeah. Sometimes I wonder how I'll ever make it into this world without having you. I just don't have a clue. And sometimes it seems that this world closes ahead of me, and there's no way of breaking free. And then I see you reach for me. Sometimes I want to give up, I want to give in, I want to quit the fight. And then I see you, baby, and everything's alright. And everything's alright when I see you smile. I can face the world. Oh, you know I can do anything when I see you smile. I see your rings of life. Oh, I see you shining right to the way now when I see you smile. Oh girl, baby, when I see you smile at me. Oh, baby, I don't know my lady, I don't know she baby, yeah. Baby, there's nothing in this world I could ever do, but a touch of your hands can do. It's like nothing that I ever need, yeah. And when the rain is falling, I can feel it, that you're here with me now. I wanna ask you, baby, if everything's alright, if everything's alright. When I see you smile, I can face the world. Oh, you know I can do anything. When I see you smile, I see your rays right. Oh, I see you shining right to the way now. When I see you smile, oh girl, baby, when I see you smile at me. Oh, baby, I don't know my lady, I don't know she baby, yeah. When I see you smile, I see your rays right. Oh, I see you shining right through the way now. When I see you smile, oh girl, baby, when I see you smile at me, oh baby, I don't know my lady, I don't know she baby, yeah. When I see you smile, I can face the world. Oh, you know I can do anything. When I see you smile, oh girl, baby, when I see you smile at me, oh baby.
Yeah, that's a lovely song. I've not heard that one. So it's When I See You Smile, singing sweet. How did you find that song, sorry?
That was my daughter's choice. So she's a bit of a selector. She has got the best musical taste of anybody I know.
Yeah.
And she just played it to me in the car one day and I just fell in love with it, but it's one of the ones I was put on. It just really, it's yeah. so upbeat. It reminds me of Cheer. Someone walking along the street, swinging the bag.
Yeah, nice.
You know, just, oh, fills me with joy. Love it.
So what we're going to do, we've got about 6 minutes left, well, and we've got one last song to play, which is about 3 minutes long, so we can chat for 3 minutes. But I suppose it's really, we should finish this kind of what's life like these days, what's in general.
Great.
So
yeah, it's varied, it's lovely. So I set up on my own 2012. Sheffield was good to me, you know, like I'd been good to it over the years, and it really supported me. So I started like getting contracts almost straight away. Didn't miss a beat really, and I've been.
But that's because you've kind of been around Sheffield so long.
I think
so the contracts were in terms of coaching and stuff, was it?
Coaching, consultancy, and kind of lots of stuff in the arts. I'm on lots of boards and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And then moved outside Sheffield now, so I work with a lot of clients all over the country and some big names. And
go on. No, you said
I could have possibly my client confidentiality, some proper names. But I do a lot of training now in the music industry. So I train mentors and coaches, so people who are like music managers or business people, so they support younger people. So it's still got that kind of purpose led, giving back, supporting younger people. I'm not going to retire, but as I try and slow down a bit, I'm doing even more of that. And then I'm writing poetry, doing some spoken word.
Amazing, yeah.
Doing also, I'm getting taught how to DJ, and I'm going to do some DJing at No Bounds. So,
okay. Well, I think there's slots at Sheffield Live available.
Well, don't tell me. I haven't got enough room. But, yeah, it's a nice, varied, interesting... Like, if you told me back in 2011 when I left the council that life would be like this, I wouldn't have believed you.
Yeah, I mean, that's a scary thing to do, wasn't it? It must have been scary at the time.
It was scary because the kids were little and I was the main breadwinner.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I didn't have a choice, really. You know, sometimes you've just got to, for your own integrity, you've got to go.
Yeah, yeah. So, well, that coach then must have kind of given you that
she was brilliant.
Belief and...
Yeah, and I still work with her, actually. Yeah. She asked me to go and work with her. And then I got a little sideline as an academic, so I do lots of teaching and teach other people how to
coach. You're doing lots and lots of different things.
Yeah,
amazing.
Loads of things.
And you can pick and choose now, I suppose,
yeah,
a bit.
Yeah.
Oh, well, thank you. It's been amazing. I've really enjoyed the last hour. So you've just got probably time just to introduce your last song. Just tell a bit about that.
To choose this. So my son is a musician. He's 27, but he started very young. He was a bit of a child prodigy. But the reason I've chosen this track, it's off one of his early albums. I think he was 18 when he made this. It was on a Sheffield label called CPU, and he was the first Sheffield artist they'd put records out. They're international, but he was from Sheffield. Anyway, the reason I chose it is because it was played at both his grandfather's funerals, and I'll have it at mine. And it's a beautiful track, and it's played on the old piano that used to be at my dad's house, so that's why it's all out of tune. It's like my dad's old wonky piano. But it's a very special track. It's not his, I mean, there's lots of brilliant tracks. He's an artist called 96 Back.
And is he still going in under that name, is it?
He's down in London now and he's killing it, but he's doing really well. But this was one of his early ones, but it's very special.
Oh, thank you, Ariel.
Made in Rotherham.
Pleasure. Okay, let's play that. So it's Vence.
It's called Vence. He's got weird names for all his tracks, but he's called 96
Black. 96 Black. All right, thanks so much.
You're very welcome.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.